All right. Members, let's... Thanks. We're going to get started here. We only have an hour to do this. So, Aaron, Representative Murphy, will you move the minutes of the February 11th meeting?
Move, Mr. Chair.
All right. Everybody have a chance to review those? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Okay. So we have two bills up today. We only have an hour for the hearing. And so, you know, I have been going around the state for the last year having to explain how I'm going to balance the state budget in 1 minute or less. So you can get your stuff done very briefly, okay? So let's keep our testimony as brief and concise as possible. Representative Liebling, which one you want to...
All right. We'd like to begin with Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Liebling moves that House File 1641 be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Commerce. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Go ahead.
All right. Well, thank you. First of all, I have an author's amendment, members, that is in your packets, should be in your packets, and it's the A1 amendment. And before I offer this, I would just like to make a couple of oral corrections to the amendment. First of all, on line 1.16 of the amendment, it should say, instead of lines 34 to 35, it should say to 34 to 36. Then on line 1.19 of the amendment, instead of subdivision 2, it should say subdivision 3, I believe. Maybe Mr. Chen can help me there. I think it should say subdivision 3.
Mr. Jay, I didn't hear the question. I'm sorry.
It's on the amendment on line 1.19 should be subdivision 3. Is that correct? Instead of subdivision 2?
Of the amendment, I'm sorry.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's basically replacing an existing subdivision 4. So I think it could stay 4. If the question is about line 1.18, is that the question?
It's on line 1.19. Subdivision 2 changed to subdivision 3.
Yes, that should be
okay.
Okay, thank you. And then on line 1.22, after the word distributor, it should say, to insert the words, or medical device manufacturer or distributor.
Is that all of them?
And then one more on line 1.24, after the word medication, insert the words or device.
Okay. Does everybody have those amendments, those modifications? We can repeat them.
Can you mention which bill we're talking about?
1341. 1641.
Okay.
Yes. And the A1 amendment, and Representative Liebling is 1.16 changing 35 to 36, 1.19 changing subdivision 2 to subdivision 3. On 1.22, after drug distributor, say, or medical device manufacturer or distributor. And on 1.24, after medication, add the words or device. And those are the modifications. We don't have to vote on that. So this is to get the bill in the order I think the author would like it to be. So any questions about what the content of the amendment is? Seeing none, all in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Liebling.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just going to go very quickly through what the bill does now as amended, and then I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Wyckoff, who's going to talk a little bit about the general problem that we're trying to address here. So basically, this bill expands and clarifies the existing pharmaceutical gift ban in Minnesota. What it does not do is extend the gift ban to medical device manufacturers. That is what the amendment just did, was to remove that from the bill. And it also it uses the gift definition that applies to us as legislators. So it would be the $5 limit and the same definition that we are under as legislators. I think a lot of it is pretty much self-explanatory. One of the things that the amendment does is it removes the requirement for practitioners to do some kind of a report if they receive gifts, but it does retain the requirement for pharmaceutical companies and for medical device manufacturers to do a report of gifts that they give. So even though I'm exempting medical device manufacturers from the bill, they are from the gift ban, they are still required to report under this bill. As far as practitioners themselves, the amendment puts in a section called notification, and that just basically cleans up and brings together a couple of things that were in the original bill. And it basically says that when a practitioner is has a financial relationship with a company and is prescribing that company's drug or device, that practitioner should simply reveal that to his or her patient. So that seemed to me to be a fair thing to ask practitioners to do. So our intent in doing this bill is certainly not to impugn anyone's integrity. We know that you know, practitioners in particular are busy. They are doing their best on behalf of their patients, but we do think that gifts and that they are influenced by gifts, and that it's important to add a layer of transparency to this whole process. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Wyckoff, who's going to talk a little bit more about what the problem is that we're trying to address.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Representative Thiessen, committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this afternoon. I'm Peter Wyckoff. I'm a consultant actually with the Community Catalyst, a collaboration of Pew Charitable Trust. And I'm working directly for now the Minnesota Prescription Coalition. Before my retirement in 2006, I was the founding director of both the Minnesota and Metropolitan Senior Federations for more than three decades. Minnesota Prescription Coalition is an incredibly broad-based coalition, which the members are described in this document right here, which has just been passed out. It's, I think, the only colored sheet you have, and a direction of labor groups, consumer organizations, provider groups, payer organizations, coming together around a concern of prescribing integrity issues. We are concerned that the marketing of the pharmaceutical industry demonstrably influences physicians' prescribing patterns, interferes with unbiased, scientific, and patient-centered approaches to diagnosis and appropriate treatment. The goal of our coalition is to eliminate conflicts of interest created by the pharmaceutical industry marketing, to increase public trust in the medical profession, and to expand the use of evidence-based prescribing through both institutional and public policy reform. We come to address two underlying issues: out-of-control prescription marketing and undue influence of the industry on government. A lot of people think when you see a direct-to-consumer advertising, that's where all the money from the industry goes. As this chart will show, almost two-thirds of all the dollars spent by the industry, actually in 2008, over $20 billion, was spent not to influence us as consumers, but to influence your doctor's prescribing habits. And that's where the major emphasis of this program is. I have 13 pages of testimony here. I will not give you that. I just want to summarize some of the hard points. It has been shown that pharmaceutical industry marketing the physician undermines the quality of care and increased costs throughout the healthcare system. Roughly one-third of all pharmaceutical revenue is spent on marketing, two to three times the amount spent on pharmaceutical research. A couple things you need to look at in those areas and what those gifts are all about. Even small gifts create obligations and influence prescribing decisions. Free samples create brand loyalty to brand. Doctors sometimes are paid to promote expensive new drugs and off-label uses, as you will hear dramatically in testimony this afternoon. 84% of physicians themselves believe that gifts influence prescribing decisions. Now, the reason they do this, and they spend that many billions of dollars a year, because it works. An indication is that over 18% of all the costs we have on drugs, and right now drugs are consuming over 17% of our entire national healthcare expenditure. According to the University of Minnesota, Not only is this the fastest growing, but it's due to, in the next 25 years, to consume over 20% of our healthcare expenditure. It is also the fastest growing part of this area. So a doctor choosing which drug to give his patient has a conflict of interest if he is being paid by a company that markets that drug. Some financial relationships, such as gifts from a company to a healthcare provider, are unnecessary, do not contribute to patient care, and are easily eliminated. Other relationships, such as research, are necessary and beneficial. But in that area, we need greater transparency. Major reports by the Institute of Medicine this past summer, MedPAC, the advisory committee, and other leading professions all talk about the need to increase transparency and really see no good in this kind of gifting relationship. There's an increasing body of evidence, which is well documented in my testimony, which talks about that. Surveys show that physicians recognize that this potential influence, even while often believing they are personally not affected. In one study, only 1% of the medical residents said that their own prescribing was heavily influenced by industry sales representatives. But those same doctors were much more likely to say that their peers were heavily influenced. In fact, 84% said their peers were heavily or somewhat influenced by sales representatives. So we believe that the quality of healthcare prescribing suffers, as we will assume. We assume that scientific integrity will ensure patient safety, but marketing can and does compromise rational prescribing. Interaction between drug companies and physicians undermine the public trust in the profession. In 2007, coming off the current Minnesota law, a whole series of articles in the New York Times related to those problems, including off-label use, a direct relationship between the amount of dollars going to doctors and their use of off-label use. And you will hear some of that in tragic results this afternoon in testifying. In the last session, Dr. Don Jacobs, a highly respected general surgeon in our community for almost 32 years, the past 9 years, who serves as CEO for Hennepin County Medical Faculty, spoke of his concerns in this area. Clinical advice, like votes, should never be bought. The issues have been discussed widely for the past 20 years, yet we have made very little progress. The financial stakes are high, Dr. Jacobs points out. We know conclusively that gifts, even small ones, in payments such as meals, consulting, and speaking fees have been shown to influence medical decisions and increase healthcare costs. The public is justifiably concerned about the hidden financial relationship with the industry and the profession. And so it's in those areas that we set as the backdrop for this bill.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Next, we have Chris McCoy.
All right.
Welcome to the committee.
Hello. Thank you, Chairman Tyson. My name is Dr. Christopher McCoy. I am a practicing internal medicine physician in Rochester. I do work for the Mayo Clinic, but I do not represent the Mayo Clinic's views. Rather, I am the chair of the National Policy Committee of the National Physicians Alliance, which is a national organization founded by physicians to restore the trust and integrity in the practice of medicine. So I come here to offer our strong support for this legislation to strengthen the ban on gifts from drug companies to healthcare providers. Minnesota already has one of the strongest laws in the country. However, even small gifts influence physicians. Gifts create a social obligation to give back. But physicians cannot give gifts back to the drug reps. In fact, they have policies against accepting gifts from us. So the only outlet for our reciprocation is through the prescriptions that we write. And curiously, most physicians believe that gifts don't affect them personally, but gifts do affect their colleagues. The constant messaging from the drug companies alters our perception of how to treat diseases. For instance, a study compared a medication for diabetes against diet and exercise, preventing the development of diabetes in at-risk patients. The medication was effective, but not as effective as diet and exercise. The drug company promoted the medication, but since no company profits from the promotion of diet and exercise, that solution was not heavily marketed to us. Instead of gifts and gizmos, let me tell you what I want from the drug companies. Safe, effective drugs that cure diseases for my patients. Nationwide, the pharmaceutical companies annually spend $20.5 billion promoting their products, including $12 billion on detailing to physicians and other healthcare providers. In Minnesota alone, the pharmaceutical industry disclosed $31 million given to physicians from 2002 to 2004. The cost of developing a drug from the laboratory science to a finished product for patients is estimated to be about $1 billion. That means if the drug companies invested their current spending on promoting drugs to doctors instead of research and development, we would have half a dozen new drugs every single year. That's half a dozen new ways that I can cure my patients. That's what I want from drug companies, not gifts, gizmos, dinners, and other trinkets. The pharmaceutical industry further claims that if they didn't promote their products, doctors wouldn't know about the nearest cures for their patients. Let me assure you that if the drug companies came up with the cure for cancer, we would prescribe it. The drug would sell itself. The drug companies only have to promote drugs that only have a marginal benefit or none at all over those that are currently available in order to increase their market sales. And finally, part of this legislation addresses open disclosure between physicians and the drug company contracts that they have and the research they do. This, again, furthers the trust from our patients and lets them know whether or not physicians have interactions with drug companies. This is not necessarily to demonize physicians, because many patients would want to find physicians who are working on cures for particular diseases or working on contracts to research various things. And so it allows patients to find the physicians who are working with drug companies to explore those areas in an open and disclosed way. Gifts, dinners, and social pleasantries are part of any business exchange, so why are prescriptions any different? Well, it doesn't cost me to write a prescription for a patient. The cost of the medication is paid for by that patient, or their insurance company, or for individuals on public assistance, the taxpayer. If a physician selects an expensive medication when a cheap generic would be just as effective, the physician doesn't feel a financial impact. However, the payer does. The doctor benefits, the patient pays. The prescription exchange is not a standard business encounter. There is a compelling public interest to eliminate gifts altogether. As a physician, I have a fiduciary responsibility to my patients. My patients trust that I have their best interest in mind when I put that pen to the prescription pad. Even the appearance of a conflict of interest degrades that trust. On behalf of my patients and my colleagues, I urge you to support House File Assistance. Thank you.
Any questions, members? Thank you. We're switching the order.
Okay. Yes. Cody Weiber.
Cody's over here.
Mr. Weiber. Welcome to the committee. Welcome.
Hi. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Cody Weiberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Pharmacy. I see him listed as a proponent. I think what I'm actually here to do is to explain some background of the current program. The Board of Pharmacy has considered this bill and is actually neutral on it, except for one thing, and that is the Board of Pharmacy is currently collecting this information, and this would be transferred to the Health Department. And the board is not opposed to having this duty transferred to the health department. So that's really where the board is on this. In terms of the background, just very briefly, a law was passed in 1993, long before my time with the board, that established Minnesota as the first state in the country to have this sort of a program where there would be a partial gift ban, and there would also be a reporting requirement so that pharmaceutical manufacturers would have to report certain payments that they make. My understanding, I've been with the board since September 2005. My understanding from my office manager, who's been there for 30 years, is that prior to about 2004, there wasn't much interest in that law. No one had asked to even see the records. But in 2004, Public Citizen came and asked to look at the records, copied the records, as part of a study that they were doing for both Minnesota and then in Vermont, which by that time had a similar law. By the time I got there in September 2005, I have to admit I didn't even know this law existed, but within 2 or 3 days of being in my office, I got the first phone call from a law firm in D.C. that represented a pharmaceutical manufacturer, and they wanted to know, since gift is not defined in the current law, they wanted to know if meals were gifts. And I took a look at the current statute, decided in some circumstances meals might very well be gifts, and told that to the manufacturer. About 3 weeks later, they sent me a email to which they had attached a letter that my predecessor had sent them, in which he had used the section of statute that defines gifts for members of the legislature, and he had somehow concluded that meals were not gifts. I was puzzled by that. I didn't see how this applied, but I nevertheless, and the difference between my predecessor and I is we were both initially trained as pharmacists. He later went on to be an attorney. I am not. By that time, in just a couple of weeks, I had received a number of different related questions. And I took all of these questions and I sent them to the Attorney General's office for a formal legal opinion. And the AG actually agreed with my interpretations. And flash forward for about a year, other reporters, including Gardner Harris, Mr. Wyckoff mentioned that there was a series of articles in the New York Times, other reporters, including Gardner Harris of the New York Times, some reporters from Minnesota Public Radio, and others, started wanting this information. And so what I did is I had my staff actually copy all these reports from the mid-1990s. Actually, they scanned them into Adobe documents so that we could burn them onto a CD the next time someone wanted them. That was really just to make sure my staff didn't have to repeatedly copy thousands of pages. Then in January 2007, Public Citizen published an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association that detailed their findings in Minnesota and Vermont, which I have to admit were somewhat critical of the way that we handled it. And that's when the media and everyone wanted those reports, everybody. We had hospitals in the state. We had healthcare systems. We had individual physicians. We had individual citizens who wanted access to this. At that point, after burning through 25 CDs in about 2 days, I had my staff put all of those documents on the board's website where they are today. And as one more advancement a couple of years ago, instead of having the manufacturers submit paper forms, we told them to go onto the website, download a spreadsheet template, and to report electronically, because one of the complaints we had about Adobe documents is you can't search them. I'll say that I think the board has done what it can with these documents. The board never received an appropriation to do anything with them, and in fact, the law does not direct the board to do anything with them. So, you know, that's a bit of the history, and I can stand for any questions about how the current program is working.
Any questions, members? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay. We have Craig Stevens.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I have a prepared statement for the committee.
We have a page.
Yeah, thank you. Whatever. Yeah. Okay.
Page. Yeah.
Welcome.
Thank you, Representative and fellow committee members. Thank you for taking the time to meet on this important issue. First of all, my name is Craig Stevens. I am a pharmacist by training. I have been in the healthcare industry for over 25 years, and I'd like to share with you my experiences and specifically to these bills that are before us, the undue influence of pharmaceutical industry in prescribing behaviors. My current role, I am the practice leader of a pharmacy benefit consulting company. I want to make it clear that my statements here are not representative of Evergreen RX, my company, rather they are my own. My company specifically provides independent, unbiased advice to health plans and labor coalitions on selecting prescription drug benefits. We take great pride in our independence as we do not take broker fees, we do not take commissions from this industry. Throughout my 25 years in the industry, I've gone through youthful exuberance as a newly trained pharmacist, thinking I could cure patients, to within 5 years realizing that this business is a business and it's about money. Upon return to school, I got into the business side of healthcare and spent many years health plans, pharmaceutical benefit managers, 8 years in the pharmaceutical industry itself with GlaxoSmithKline. My role in that position was responsibility on a national basis for ensuring that a large health insurance company named United Health Group would pay for and promote our portfolio of products. Within that, not only was there price concessions being made, which are commonly termed rebates, but there was also a significant amount of dollars that would exchange hands as value-added services. Clinical education, promotion of disease programs, which would include what I would call clinical half-truths. You would also have at your disposal nearly 9,000 field representatives across the country, which could call on specific physicians to deliver the message that you needed delivered. This, of course, creates undue influence in prescribing behavior. Interestingly, on an annual basis, I was provided a substantial seven-figure budget that I was required to spend. I was challenged if I did not spend it, why I was not spending that money. The creativity that comes forth to spend those type of dollars, I could speak to you for hours on. Ultimately, this has become an overcomplicated system with too much concentration of power and a lot of undue influence by too many profit-motivated legal hierarchies. In retrospect, as I've come full circle now, and I've my youthful exuberance has returned, I now feel it's important that I speak the truth of this industry. This industry does bring value. There is significant research and development activity. However, it is small in comparison to the promotional activity that is occurring behind the scenes and influencing the relationship you have with your physician. On top of that, and this was touched on in the previous discussion, the pricing model is hidden. As an individual patient, you maybe have a copayment. You maybe have a co-insurance. But someone else is picking up the tab. So to ask for that preferred product or for a physician to write for that preferred product is really no skin off of anyone's game except someone upstream that has the risk. There's no alignment of free market incentives here whatsoever. Free market requires access to information. It doesn't exist. Another example I'd like to bring forward in my 10-year in pharmaceutical industry, just to show the power of the marketing arm of a pharmaceutical company. I witnessed in my 10-year a chemical product, a pharmaceutical product that had been researched, had been studied, and had literally been put on a shelf and determined this product had no differentiation, had no clinical improvements over existing therapies, and was put to bed. Around 2002, two of Glaxo's large products came under patent threat, and significant revenue was at risk. This chemical was taken off a shelf, polished. A significant marketing campaign was put behind it. It is now on direct-to-consumer advertising on television, and it is a $1 billion drug. No clinical evidence. Granted, it was safe. Granted, it was better than placebo. But it was no better than the generics on the market. In summary, I'm confident my position will be contested by representatives of the pharmaceutical industry. It's a very strong organization. The questions will come forth as to who will educate the physicians on drug therapy. Well, let me tell you, we don't need education that only talks about the good and doesn't talk about the bad. Because what we see is, of all the clinical studies that are being performed, the only information that ever gets communicated to physicians are those which shine a very bright light on the product being promoted. Thank you very much for your time, and I'd take any questions.
Any questions, members? Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Kim, no, excuse me, Michelle Kimball.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. If it pleases the committee, I do have copies of my testimony.
That would be great. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Once again, I'm Michelle Kimball. I am the State Director of AARP here in Minnesota, and I proudly represent nearly 700,000 consumers over the age of 50. Older Minnesotans have a huge stake in the debate over the cost of prescription drugs and the marketing practices of pharmaceutical companies. Prices of drugs continue to rise, having a direct negative effect on older and disabled Minnesotans, especially those on fixed incomes. Older consumers want policymakers to do whatever they can to control costs. But these proposals before you are not just about drug costs. They are about quality and ethical health care, and it's about ensuring that our loved ones get the right drug and the right information whenever they visit their doctor. Frustration about the negative effects of the pharmaceutical industry's marketing practices is actually at an all-time high, and Minnesota consumers believe that too many conflicts of interest exist between doctors and pharmaceutical companies, especially here in Minnesota, and this is why AARP supports the Pharmaceutical and Medical Device Gift Ban Act, House File 1641. We believe it will help to reduce the conflicts of interest that currently exist between doctors and pharmaceutical companies. House File 1641 improves Minnesota's current pharmaceutical gift ban and closes some important loopholes. And consumers should have the right to know whether their physician or other health care provider has accepted gifts from a pharmaceutical manufacturer. And they also have the right to know what kind of effect that this may have in their doctor prescribing the drugs for their care. Consumers really need to be able to trust that the drugs that they are receiving are the best and most effective to meet their needs, and they're not just receiving them because the doctor was unduly influenced by gifts from pharmaceutical companies. AARP believes strongly that nothing should come between you and your doctor, and that includes pharmaceutical companies. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Okay, thank you very much.
All right, and finally we have Kim Witzak. I hope I'm pronouncing it right.
Yeah. How are you?
Hi, good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. My name's Kim Witzak, and I'm from Minneapolis, and I come here today as a member, or just as a consumer, and also to put a face on what can happen to a real family. On August 6, 2003, my husband of almost 10 years, Woody, died of Zoloft-induced suicide at age 37. He was not depressed, nor did he have a history of depression or any other mental illness. He died after taking the drug for a total of 5 weeks, with the dosage being doubled shortly before his death. He was given the antidepressant from his general physician for insomnia. Woody loved life. Woody was compassionate, loyal. He was fun, but to me, he was simply my best friend, my husband, who I was supposed to grow old with. Woody had a successful career in sales and had just started his dream job as vice president of sales with a startup company. He was excited about this new opportunity, and along with the excitement came difficulty sleeping, which is not uncommon for people starting their own business. So on June 30th, 2003, Woody went to his family doctor, and after a consultation with him, he was given Zoloft for insomnia. It was the first time he'd ever gone to the doctor for this sort of thing. The three-week sample pack that Woody came home with automatically doubled the dose, unbeknownst to him, after week one. No cautionary warning was given to him about the need to be closely monitored when first going on these drugs. In fact, I was out of the country on the first 3 weeks that he was on this drug. Within days, Woody experienced every known side effect of Zoloft, including depersonalization and akathisia, which is a neurologically inclined condition that causes internal restlessness and agitation. Shortly before his death, Woody came home after driving around all day, and he sat in the fetal position with his hands around his head saying, "Help me, Kim, I don't know what's happening to me. It's like my head's outside my body looking in." 2 weeks later, a total of 5 weeks on the drug, Woody was found hanging from the rafters in our garage by my dad. We tried many things during this period to find out why Woody suddenly changed from sleeplessness to having all these new issues. We were unaware, unwarned, that Zoloft, the drug that is touted and sold to help, is actually causing Woody harm. We only wish that we knew then what we know now. It was not in Woody's head, it was the drug. While still struggling to cope with this loss, I've chosen to use my experience to try and make a difference. Since Woody died, I've spent countless hours trying to determine what happened to Woody and how our current system has failed. Woody was given a 3-week sample of Zoloft by his general practitioner for insomnia. Insomnia is an off-label use for Zoloft. I now know that a great deal of information doctors get about the drugs comes from the drug company representatives directly. They inform the doctors of the attributes of their product or different potential uses for their drug. From my work on these issues here in Minnesota and in Washington, I've also learned that many, many financial ties exist between the doctors, health care providers, and pharmaceutical companies. Financial incentives influence doctors. I believe this influence, which includes gifts, played a role in Woody being prescribed Zoloft off-label, which ultimately led to his death. Ethics are already in existence for world-class companies such as Target, 3M, Kraft, Walmart, Walgreens. They cannot accept any gift from their vendors or suppliers. Why? In absence of this ethic lies the potential of influence in buying and purchasing decisions. It seems to me that we should have the same sort of standard for our healthcare providers whom we trust are making the best decision for us and our families. I want it to be based on the doctor's knowledge, their experience, that's based on unbiased scientific information, not as a result of being directly or indirectly influenced by the industry. Patients deserve more. Families deserve more. We need to trust that our healthcare providers are giving us the best healthcare possible. Nothing should come between my doctor and me and my doctor, certainly not the drug companies. So I urge you to do whatever you can do to eliminate conflicts of interest that exist between doctors and pharmaceutical companies. And these bills before you are a step in the right direction. So I believe Woody's death was preventable, and I just don't want what happened to our family to happen to yours. So thank you for having me today.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions for the witness? Thank you for coming today. Representative Liebling. I think
that's the extent of our testimony on this bill.
Okay, well, let's go to the people. Well, who do we have signed up? Mr. Gerhardt, Mr. Root, and Ms. Powell. Go ahead, Mr.
Chair. Thank you for allowing us to appear before you today. My name is Don Gerhardt. I'm the CEO of Life Science Alley. Life Science Alley is a trade association based in Minnesota of approximately 600 medtech, biotech, and life science companies. We represent those 600 over 600 companies that employ over 250,000 Minnesota employees, and we really appreciate being able to talk to you today. I'm going to shorten my talk way down, so let me skip through a number of pieces. We really don't intend at all to minimize the serious issues that are being heard by this committee and the sincerity and hard work that Representative Liebling and her staff have come forth with on this. At the same time, we think there's some weaknesses that put some very difficult positions into our state that are not needed. So I'd like to make four really quick points. We feel very strongly that There is a federal solution to what we're talking about, that we ought not to let add additional expense and additional layers of government in Minnesota, and that there's a very clear and very definite federal solution to this. Now, if any of you have been before Senator Grassley or Senator Klobuchar, you know that this isn't being taken lightly by those two. So we ask for federal legislation that can cover the what we're talking about and cover it not 50 times. So what we would be doing, we would be adding to the administrative load of all of our companies in Minnesota. We would be identifying Minnesota as a place not to do work, and we'll have a CEO here that can tell you about that in just a little bit. Second, while we understand the target is inappropriate marketing practices, this legislation would also hit a very key part to the medical device combination product business in Minnesota. Drug-coated stents, for instance, would be included because they have a drug contained on them, and an extremely difficult interaction.
My understanding is that the amendment removed that piece of the
legislation. It may. It's not really clear how, as those that kind of device.
I think the intent is that that happens. So, if you have concerns about that, why don't you talk to Representative Liebling?
Okay. Thirdly, Minnesota has adopted the strictest gift ban legislation in the country. We don't think that it needs to be added to again, and we think that federal law, the federal approach, is the answer to that. Fourthly, we understand that this is a very, very important issue for the integrity of the life science community in our state. The medical device and pharmaceutical industry, the University of Minnesota, and certain local hospitals are all undertaking voluntary disclosure initiatives. Medtronic has announced that it will voluntarily disclose its relationships, and both AdvaMed and Pharma have very strict codes of conduct that are in place. So that we think Minnesota is putting enormous amounts of new efforts in funding from the legislature, as well as the University of Minnesota, private funding, et cetera, that are building things like the Minnesota Partnership for Medical Genomics and Biotechnology, the Biobusiness Alliance of Minnesota, the Biomedical Bonding Authority, et cetera, and we're just beginning a new growth. Do not throw an additional hoop for these organizations to jump through. Allow us to come under the federal legislation, which is very appropriate. Next, Howard Root, CEO of Vascular Solutions, will talk to you. Thank you very much, Mr.
Welcome
Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Thank you. Questions for the witness? Representative Bond. Okay, why don't we go ahead, Mr. Root.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Howard Root. I'm CEO of Vascular Solutions, which is a medical device company based in Maple Grove. I'm a native Minnesotan, having grown up in St. Anthony Village, and a graduate of the University of Minnesota. In 1997, I became associated with a physician who had an idea for a new medical device. So I took $300 of my own money and started Vascular Solutions. Over the last 13 years, Vascular Solutions has worked with many physicians to develop new products, with over 50 medical devices currently manufactured and sold, used in treating a variety of vascular diseases ranging from heart attacks to varicose veins. Our sales in 2009 were approximately $70 million. We have over 250 employees, all of whom are based in Maple Grove, with the exception of our field sales force, which is located throughout the U.S. Now, while Vascular Solutions is classified as a medical device company, one of our major products is a blood clotting bandage that uses thrombin, which is viewed by the FDA as a biologic, or in other words, a prescription drug. Therefore, like many other medical device companies that have similar types of new combination products, we are also a pharmaceutical company, and in the way that this is written right now would be included in the gift ban portion of this legislation. In addition, even a company that sells only pure medical devices would be required to comply with the new annual disclosure obligations in the proposed legislation. So I want to take just 4 or 5 minutes here to briefly explain how the proposed legislation would affect Vascular Solutions and many similar types of Minnesota medical device and healthcare companies. First, the new disclosure obligations would require us to report, quote, all payments or other compensation paid to sponsors of medical conferences or other education programs, close quote. We attend over 50 medical meetings each year with a variety of payments made for our exhibit space, our sponsorships, and related items. We also provide patient education services at local health fairs, particularly with regard to local screening for varicose veins. In addition, our 90 field employees make over 30,000 hospital visits each year, and each visit could include payments for educational activities, which is required by the FDA as part of the training obligations for our company. So under the proposed legislation, we would need to have an employee track all of these expense reports and then file an annual disclosure for any payments, even if it was as little as $1. And the content of that disclosure, which would disclose payments for exhibit hall space or local health fair sponsorships, would be absolutely irrelevant to any health care consumer. Furthermore, since we sell our devices in all 50 states, if every state were to adopt its own version of this legislation, this would quickly become an even bigger administrative headache, requiring multiple full-time people at our company to review and prepare the reports. Now, a better approach is obviously a federal, not state legislation with a uniform category of relevant disclosures of payments to healthcare professionals. The Federal Sunshine Act legislation accomplishes this in pending in Congress with both the MDMA, of which I'm on the board of directors, and AdvaMed, which are the two medical device trade organizations, publicly supporting its passage. Now, an even more harmful provision of the proposed legislation amends the definition of what a gift is that is prohibited from being provided to healthcare practitioners. When we sometimes pay a physician to provide education and training to our sales force, which would be prohibited by the proposed legislation unless we have, quote, no influence on the content, presenters, or attendees at the event, close quote, which obviously is impossible in these types of situations. Even more importantly, we often interact with physicians on the design and clinical use of our new products, which would be prohibited by the proposed legislation unless it is at their standard hourly billing rate and meets other requirements. Let me give you a very specific example of how that last limitation would impact our development of new life-saving products. We're currently working with a physician who has used one of our products to save the life of a young mother suffering from postpartum pulmonary thromboembolism, which is the leading cause of death of a mother following delivery. The physician is taking our product and providing advice to us on creating a specially tailored version of it. If the proposed legislation were adopted, it would be prohibited for me to pay that doctor's expenses to travel to Minnesota to discuss his ideas, or for me to buy him dinner at a medical meeting to discuss his case, or to provide a royalty to him on the inventions because it could be higher than his hourly billing rate. This type of restriction on interactions with our medical advisors would damper our product development efforts and really would undercut the business strategy that I use to create vascular solutions. And finally, I want to very briefly comment on the premise behind this legislation that healthcare companies are corrupting physicians and need to be kept a safe distance away. And with all due respect, that's the wrong answer for the Minnesota economy, and it's the wrong answer for healthcare. Minnesota's healthcare economy is a strength that does not need a stimulus payment to continue its growth, but it also will not continue to grow our employment if we place burdensome state restrictions on our disclosures and the restrictions on our ability to create new products. That product development has resulted in many breakthrough medical devices in Minnesota. The pacemaker, the mechanical heart valve, and the septal occluder are all examples of life-saving products that were developed by Minnesota companies working in close partnership with Minnesota physicians. Simply put, you cannot both vilify the healthcare industry as a corrupting influence and also expect increased employment and continued medical breakthroughs. And I find it ironic that the same hospital systems that advertise on billboards on every freeway and give away coffee mugs and pens at every health fair are objecting to the costs and influence associated with the promotion of medical devices, especially since they can control it for their own physicians. So I strongly urge you not to adopt this legislation. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, Mr. Chair, could you clarify the path that this bill would be taking from today?
The motion is to go to the Commerce Committee.
To Commerce Committee. Thank you. Okay. And after that, would it be going to Finance or to Health?
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. I
think it's actually going to go to Representative Mahoney's committee as well. That's my understanding.
Okay. Yeah. To the testifiers, if you could, on the issue, first of all, on the issue of the payment to physicians for participating in, or whether they can participate in trains, and then also what their payment is for being involved with you in various kinds of projects or discussions, I agree with you that the bill seems inadequately addressing that. Obviously, we don't even know what billing rate is. And obviously, that isn't necessarily the value that we should be paid for these kinds of things that are outside their normal medical.
Can you pull your microphone closer?
Sorry. Yeah. So I think clearly there's an area there to be worked on. So that's the comment part of it. But in terms of the issue of the federal legislation, It's in play, but we don't know if it will pass. First of all, do you have any sense of the likelihood of passing? And secondly, if it were not to pass, would it? I can imagine that one could write the state legislation such that at such time a federal bill comes forward, we could allow it to preempt or we could revisit the topic. So I'm trying to look at ways to address the issues you raise, as to say, just, you know, it's all black and white one way or the other. So can you comment on that?
I can directly respond to the last point better than the first. If something does not pass federally, if we would then proceed quickly to do something in Minnesota, we're headed towards that 50 again. Mm-hmm. The 50 impacts on a company like Howard. Mm-hmm. So the R&D is going to go away and other kinds of things, they're going to have to cut costs elsewhere to keep their businesses going. So my response would be then we should go directly to Senator Klobuchar and say we need one next time around federally and support that strongly. That's what I would do.
Okay. And on behalf of MDMA, we've talked to both Senator Franken and Senator Klobuchar and Representative Paulson and indicated that we're in favor of it. Problem was that it got wrapped in the whole health care legislation. Yeah. If they strip it out, the bill has no opposition and should be adopted. But really, from our standpoint, a 250-employee company, we just can't tolerate 50 different state regulations on it. And the one federal approach is something we can tolerate and we think makes sense.
Well, to follow up, assuming we were to go to the federal approach, your last comment, Mr. Root, in terms of the burden of this paperwork and notification, is there not a notification procedure similar to this in the federal legislation?
There's a disclosure. It's one disclosure rather than 50 disclosures with one set of definitions and not 50 different definitions. So we have a hard time when we go to medical meetings to decide what state a physician is from. And so if it's from the state of Vermont, we can't do anything with them. And if it's from California, we have other restrictions, Nevada, other restrictions, Massachusetts, new restrictions, and Minnesota would be the next one to add restrictions. And it becomes such a burden for a small company, whereas Medtronic can comply with that, it's hard for us to keep track of all the state laws.
Representative
Buss? Just for clarification, then, I had interpreted your previous comments to make to on the notification issue and on disclosure to be too burdensome for anyone requiring you to do it in terms of the numbers of meetings, numbers of educations, numbers of fairs, et cetera. And so in this response that you've just given, you're saying that one such requirement done one time is something that your company is willing to absorb, just don't want 50 states and 50 different versions.
Right. We're in favor of the Sunshine Act and the federal legislation. We've been in favor of that as a company and as an industry for the last couple of years. And if they would just put it as a separate bill, we could get this thing done and it'd be a federal legislation. That requires annual disclosure to the federal government, a place where everyone can get that information easier than they can from the state, because these are international products. I highly doubt that we're going to get the full benefit by making it a Minnesota-only provision.
Representative Lane.
Mr. Root, you spoke about the woman with the postpartum situation and the doctor having a new idea that goes with it. And my knowledge in the other professional worlds that don't have necessarily products that are sold for profit is if a doctor comes up with something new, he or she shares that with the peers through journals or conferences or letters or whatever. And I don't understand why you say that he needs to be able to be paid by you to share it with you so that you can then continue the profit.
Well, there's two ways. Sure. One is our sales force has to go out and be able to talk about the product and train other physicians on those products. You can't get trained by reading a medical journal on a device that requires mechanical interaction. So I need to bring the physician into our sales meeting to train our salespeople on the appropriate use of it so they can use that information to train the physicians across the country on the appropriate use. The other thing is if he comes up with a new version of it, and he's created that spark, that ingenuity, like Dr. Lillehei did with the mechanical heart valve, I need to pay him a royalty on that. I mean, that's and that royalty is a percentage of sales. But the way the law is written, it has to be a standard hourly rate, not a percentage of sales on a royalty basis for something that would fall within that gift ban.
We've had some discussions about the hourly. One question I have, though, is if there are all these disclosures in different states, is it just that the companies you represent are going to think Minnesota is a bad place to do business because we have an anti-drug company approach, because we put some disclosure requirements in place, and so they're going to flee the state just because of that? Is that the argument you're making?
Not necessarily, but making it more difficult to do business here.
I guess my question is, this seems actually like a fairly, I suppose all these things cumulatively, but this seems like a fairly marginal additional burden to put on. And I just don't see that a company is going to decide not to do business in Minnesota or leave business in Minnesota just because of this, particularly since Vermont and a bunch of other states are already doing it.
Yeah, there's only six others.
Well, so, six other states.
I've been at the table in the negotiation of where companies are going to end up or whether they're going to move in or not. And you are absolutely right in saying the accumulative effect is enormous.
And but what about the effect of this? Would just imagine that you're going to, we're going to look to tax rates, right, first? Or that would be one argument. You're going to look to educated workforce. You're going to look to whether the University of Minnesota is investing in research and development and Mayo is investing in research and development. Personally, I don't buy the argument that a company is not going to come to Minnesota just because they're required to disclose who they give. There may be things on the margins about sponsorship. I get that. That may not be practical, but I just don't buy that argument.
I can explain for myself. The first thing I would do if this bill passed is not work with the Minnesota physician on a new idea, because I'm worried that if it gets out there and disclosed to how much money that person makes off of this idea as a percentage, it could violate the law.
Okay. There you go.
But also, it's incrementalism. I mean, no one thing causes a company to start or fail. But there are states that are throwing, one of our competitors got $3 million to put a facility in Texas. Crazy money for a small company. And Florida would do the same thing for us. And I'm committed to growing in Minnesota. But when you have these types of cumulative requirements on it, it's hard to even come up with the money to expand.
Okay. Representative Butler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to our witnesses. We are not an economic development committee or a tax policy committee, so I think we should really stay to the issue about what influences prescribing and what doesn't, or relationships. And if I'm reading the bill correctly, and I'd like you to respond, I don't see anything in here that prevents you from working with a physician who has a good idea and contracting with them to develop that idea. The only requirement that I see in here is that they would have to disclose that they have a contract with you. It's not that you are not allowed to do it. It's just an upfront declaration. And when you use the example of Dr. Lillehei, I think he was the one who actually cost us, I believe, major amounts of research funding for the University of Minnesota because of his using a drug that had not yet secured the appropriate FDA approvals, but I may be wrong on the exact physician. But I know our University of Minnesota did get into trouble with those sorts of things. And when I hear about drug, both from the patient perspective and from someone who was a sales rep, talk about promoting off-label uses of drugs, how would you suggest that we deal with those kind of risks that this bill is attempting to address?
I can respond. I believe it's Dr. Najarian you're talking about on the drug. Sorry. But Dr. Lillehei worked with Medtronic to develop the pacemaker, worked with St. Jude Medical to develop the mechanical heart valve. Met him.
Sorry, I don't know my history.
How do you deal with off-label use? The FDA is on off-label use. It's a hot button for FDA. We have training with our sales reps on what they can say, what they can't say, what the specific indication is. We have products that can be used coronary but can't be used in the neural. They have to know that, be able to instruct the physician what it's been tested on and what it's approved for. And if you don't do that, the FDA has been very stringent in enforcement efforts, particularly under the new administration, which is getting a kind of a new sense of religion in medical device companies on what they can do and what they can't do. So that's the way you control that. I forgot what the other part of your question was.
The question was I correct in understanding that that you could contract with someone in developing things, you just have to disclose it?
The gift ban says that we can do payments for genuine research as long as it's no higher than their standard hourly billing rate. And if that's the exemption for a gift, there's argument that if you give them a royalty on a development or a royalty for an invention or something that turns out to be more than their hourly rate for what they do for us, you could be violating the law as a gift.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, could I make one quick comment to that?
Quick.
We should not make the error that in not recognizing and what we're talking about. I think you're absolutely correct in talking about the prescription influence, et cetera. But it is an ecosystem that we have in our state, and we can't damage that ecosystem so that the companies that we have participating or potential ones do not want to be here or will not talk to a Minnesota doctor. If he doesn't talk to a Minnesota doctor, millions of dollars go out the door because it's both development and clinical studies, et cetera. So we have to be very careful that we don't damage the ecosystem and put ourselves at disadvantage to other states. Enormous issue.
I think we're going to go with Ms. Paul here get the testimony, and then we're going to adjourn. So go ahead.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Marjorie Powell. I'm the Senior Assistant General Counsel at the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, or PhRMA for short. So I represent the women and the men who are doing the basic laboratory research, the clinical trials, and the submissions to FDA, including women and men located here in Minnesota, to get new drugs and biologics approved. We represent both large companies and we represent very small companies. I want to be very clear at the very beginning. Pharmaceutical companies do not provide gifts to doctors. Pharma has, for a number of years, had a code of interactions with healthcare professionals. We revised this and it became effective last year. It prohibits what we call reminder items, the pens and pencils. The one I'm holding is actually from a health insurance company. I have a couple in my purse from the local hospitals in my area who send me materials trying to convince me that when I have a heart attack, I should go to this hospital versus that hospital. But pharmaceutical companies do not provide gifts to physicians. Pharmaceutical companies do, however, have an obligation when they bring a new drug to market or when they learn new information about a drug that's already on the market to make sure that physicians, nurse practitioners, everybody in the healthcare system knows how to use that drug, which patients to prescribe it for, who not to prescribe it for, when there may be an interaction with another medication. FDA has very strict regulations that require education of everybody in the healthcare system, but that require that pharmaceutical representatives, and the same is true of medical device representatives, provide information about both benefits of a drug and the risks associated with the drug. All of the information that a pharmaceutical representative presents to doctors is reviewed by the FDA when a new drug comes on the market, and FDA monitors the kinds of information that
we have only about 2 minutes, so
okay,
just
let me,
for whatever,
let me
just
see
to
if
give
I
you a heads up.
Quickly, FDA has very strict requirements. You heard earlier that a pharmaceutical representative was promoting a drug for off-label uses. That is, in fact, a firing offense at our companies. We require that companies that have signed on to the code have a system for receiving complaints, investigating complaints, and terminating representatives who are violating the company's code. All of the pharma members and a number of non-pharma members, more than 50 companies, have signed on to this code. FDA does require continuing education of doctors, and they limit what kinds of things can be said. We think that the current reporting system in Minnesota is sufficient. There is no need to establish a new system. There is no need to establish limits on what pharmaceutical companies can pay physicians who are participating in a clinical trial for a new drug, what a pharmaceutical company can pay to a physician at one of the fine healthcare systems in Minnesota who may develop an idea for a new compound that will be become effective as a new medication. Well, I also just very briefly want to remind everybody that that within the healthcare dollar, 75 cents of every dollar goes to chronic conditions. Patients with chronic conditions need to be taking the most effective medication for that condition, but medications, even with the amount of medication patients are taking for chronic conditions, prescription drug, the total cost for prescription drugs is approximately 10 cents out of every healthcare dollar. That's been the percentage for the last 20 years. Within the state's Medicaid program, it's less than 5 cents out of Medicare spending, Medicaid spending. This bill will not improve access to health care. It will not improve the quality of health care. It will not improve the treatments available to patients. It is unnecessary, and we urge you to reject it. And I would be happy to answer questions. I realize you have a very tight time limit.
Right, and people maybe can answer ask questions if you can stick around a little bit after. Representative Liebling.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just a couple real quick comments. One is that the issue about stents coated with drugs and so on, the amendment reinstated lines 2.1 through 2.3 that are struck on the original bill, and basically it exempts that. And Mr. Weiberg here was whispering in my ear that the Board of Pharmacy has been very clear that that's not included, so that's not a concern. In terms of the issue about the billing rate and all that, that's certainly fixable. I mean, I certainly would be happy to work with people who are concerned about that. But, Mr. Chair, I think
what we're going to do right now is we're going to just take the Senate advisement and pick it up later. So we're going to adjourn at this point, and we'll just kind of lay the bill over and then deal with it at another future meeting.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. We're adjourned. Members.